Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you what you know about NDEs, near-death experiences. And many of you have already heard about them. Perhaps have, some of you have had some of your own. I know someone particularly who's had two of them. And maybe people have had more of them. So we want to know more about this. And what does it mean to have a near-death experience? How real are they? What kind of scientific evidence is there about it? Who's looking at them? And what are they doing to help us understand it more? And to do that, I found a wonderful guest for our show who really has made a life study of NDEs and higher consciousness. And so I'm very happy to introduce Melvin Morse to the show. Melvin, welcome.
Hi, Peter. I'm so grateful to be on your show. As you know, I'm a former critical care pediatrician, and I worked at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital for about 20 years. And, you know, I trained at Johns Hopkins. I had the typical medical perspective on what is a near-death experience, which, you know, in our mind was just caused by medications or you know, some sort of bizarre hallucination at the point of death, et cetera. So I had the typical medical perspective on them until I happened to resuscitate a young girl named Crystal Merzlock in Pocatello, Idaho. And she, at age seven, came as close to dying. She suffered what we call clinical death, and she was completely resuscitated. And I had the chance to interview her a couple of days later, and she had drowned in this community swimming pool. And so I said to her, "So Crystal, tell me about what happened to you. You know, meaning how did it come that she drowned, or etc." And she looks at me and she says, "Do you mean when I was with the Heavenly Father?" And I laughed, and I sort of laughed, the way a teenager laughs about sex. I was embarrassed. I was like, what? That's so. And she looks at me, and she understood my laugh, that it was sort of a disbelieving laugh. And she leaned over, and she patted me on the wrist, and she said, "You'll see, Dr. Morse. Heaven is fun." And her experience was so extraordinary. She had a spirit guide named Elizabeth that took her to heaven. While she was in heaven, she met someone she thought was Jesus, and she said he was very nice. For your listeners who are Christians, nice to know. And she told me that she had to go back for a reason, and the reason was for love of her family, that her mother was to have a son, and the son would have heart disease. So she had to go back to help out her mother. And she drew me a picture. She drew me a picture of looking down from heaven and seeing her brother who had not been born yet. And certainly nobody knew that he had a heart disease at this time. And she drew him with having a very large heart in his chest. And then sure enough, about 6 months later, her brother was born. And in fact, he did have heart disease, exactly as she had described it. Wow. And that was so astonishing to me. I mean, this is something that I personally knew that she was at the point of death. She accurately described for me her own resuscitation during a time that I knew that there was no medical way that she could have known what was going on with her. And then, drawing me a picture, which 6 months later, events showed was true, I felt that I had to learn more about these experiences. And so I went back to Seattle Children's Hospital and worked with the head of the intensive care unit, Don Tyler, and head of the Department of Neurology, whose name is Jerry Milstein. And we designed really the first well-designed, what we call prospective, meaning that we interviewed all survivors of cardiac arrest at Seattle Children's Hospital over about a 15-year period of time. So we didn't we didn't have volunteers, you know, we didn't have people come to us, but we rather identified people, our children, that we thought were at the point of death, and then we interviewed them. And then we carefully compared them to control patients who also had a lack of oxygen to their brain, were also treated with a variety of different medications, and such as that, but were not near death. And we interviewed 26 children, and of them, 24 had this near-death experience. And none of them would have told anybody about their experience if we hadn't bothered to interview them. I mean, these, as one child said to me, I said to her, well, why haven't you told your parents about this experience? And she says to me, I didn't think you were supposed to be able to talk to God. You know, so even, you know, a young child knows that in our society, you know, the, we don't have a society that nurtures spiritual experiences, that's for sure. And Peter, we published our articles in the American Medical Association's pediatric journals. We published in The Lancet. And our study then inspired a physician, a cardiologist in Belgium named Pin van Lommel. And he did a far more extensive study than ours. He did a similar type of study of adults, and definitely showed that they also had near-death experiences at the point of death, and that these experiences are very real, that they're not caused by a lack of oxygen to the brain, they're not hallucinations. There really is no one who can look at the scientific literature and conclude anything but that near-death experiences are real, that this is an experience we will all have at the point of death. And as one child said to me, I love talking to children about it. She said to me, I wasn't dead. I wasn't dead at all. Some part of me was still alive. And remember, Peter, that these are children whose brains aren't working anymore. So this tells us something very important, that consciousness does not depend on brain function. And you know, when I started
is breaking up a little bit right now.
I had always bunked that the science was against spirituality. And what I have learned is that if you understand the neuroscience of spirituality, you can understand it better, that you have a far more profound understanding. You know, many of the stories that you've shared with me, stories of you know, of interacting with spirits, departed spirits, and such as that. We can only start to understand those experiences when we understand the neuroscience of what, for me, started with the near-death experience, but became a greater understanding of the neuroscience of spirituality.
But all it really does, well, it opens the door. It opens the door.
It opens the door.
Right, and then
because once you understand that the near-death experience is real, then that in turn validates all the other types of spiritual experiences, and we start to understand that we have a spiritual brain, that our brain is actually hardwired to have spiritual experiences, and I'm gonna just jump right to. Something that's near and dear to my heart is much of the reason that I published this research was for dying parents. For parents, you know, who children have died.
Right.
Because I felt this was information that they needed to know.
Right.
But what I discovered was that when I interviewed grieving parents, invariably they themselves would have profound experiences of interacting with their child who had passed.
Right.
Beautiful experiences. Waking up in the middle of the night and their child is at the foot of the bed saying, you know, mommy, stop crying. I'm okay now. Just profound experiences. The experiences in which they would actually appear to them on, you know, in a cell phone, for example, a picture of them appearing in a cell phone with no other way to explain. I had a very close friend whose daughter had passed, and on the he had a picture of her, which is a sort of a black and white kind of picture of her in the last few days of her life. And on the anniversary of her death, he happened to be looking at the picture again, and in the background was an astonishing tunnel that was all filled with bright colors that was extending out from her head that hadn't been, you know, part of the picture before that.
Wow.
And me being the scientist I am, I immediately sent it off to, you know, experts to see if it had been photoshopped or, you know, or something like that. And, you know, and sure enough, you know, they, you know, the people that examined the photo from a forensic point of view, you know, said, no, you know, this is something that's inherent in the picture itself. This is not something that was grafted onto the picture after the fact.
Right.
Well, why is this important?
I've done some shows about having the dead contact us.
Yes.
You know, so there are many.
Here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
Go on. I'm sorry.
No, there are many ways. There's a woman I interviewed recently who has a book called Never Parted, and about her brother who stayed in touch with her for a year after he died, and in many different ways that he could be in touch with her. And there are other books like that. And
exactly.
Who I've interviewed.
But here's the thing. Research on this subject, you know, from the literature research shows that perhaps 70 to 80% of grieving parents have some sort of interaction with their child who's passed. But typically they dismiss these experiences as hallucinations of a grieving parent.
Right.
They don't put any, you know, they don't give them the respect and the honor, and frankly they usually contain the seeds of healing grief. And once I understood that near-death experiences were real, I began to understand that all of these associated experiences are just as real. There's no reason to think that you know, if we have the ability that consciousness survives our brain when it's dying and dysfunctional, then there's no reason that that consciousness can't contact us later in life.
But one
and,
of the,
you know, for example,
one of the things that is difficult to comprehend, because a lot of these people who have had near-death experiences during, for instance, operations or whatever, are hovering over their bodies, watching the doctors operate on them, or they float out to the waiting room and they see people, they hear conversations out there and see it. And then these children, as you say, they can draw their experiences. They can.
Absolutely.
And so you see that their eyes and their ears were working outside of their heads. So that's what's
exactly.
Very hard for a lot of people to understand. How do we see if we're not in our brains looking out through our eyes? You know, how does the spirit that's floating outside of their body?
Beautiful. You've come right to the heart of the issue.
Okay.
And we know, for example, most of the patients that I resuscitated, we taped their eyes closed, so they're not seeing anything. And so I had this very question, Peter. You know, I said to myself, how are they seeing without a functioning brain? Because the near-death experience teaches us that consciousness survives, you know, exists independent of the brain, and then clearly uses the brain. You know, consciousness uses the brain so that we can interact with each other and talk with each other. However, this is what brings me to what's called remote viewing. And we've learned that human beings have another set of senses, and that these senses permit us to access information from the universal energy source. You know, when these children die, invariably they say that they interact with a place which has all knowledge, which has all information, you know, that most people call God, let's face it. And we can access that while we're still alive.
Right.
And so we know that through the science of remote viewing and such as that. And when you ask these children very specifically, Well, so, you know, what did you actually see? They'll tell you, Peter, they say, well, I didn't see like you see with your eyes. They'll say things, beautiful things like, heaven had so many colors that I had never seen before.
You can also see people on the other side too. They meet their relatives who have died. So they are often
absolutely
people on the other side. So how do they see them? And how do those people look to them?
Because they interact with them on an extrasensory system that doesn't depend on the ears, eyes, our typical senses. And we know that that system exists, like I was telling you, because of the science of remote viewing. We know that all human beings have the ability to obtain information from sources that don't depend on our local senses. Whether we call it intuition, whether we call it remote viewing, whether we call it mediumship, these are absolutely normal abilities that human beings have. And I'll give you an example, exactly what you're talking about. I saw this this one boy, he nearly suffocated to death because he dug one of these big tunnels on the beach, the way young kids will do. And then the tunnel collapsed on him and nearly suffocated him. And he told me that suddenly by his side, there was a wizard who was dressed in white and told him to struggle and you will live. And so I said to him, well, so what was that like for you? And he said, well, he didn't talk to me the way you and I are talking. He talked to me with his mind.
Right.
So these are mind-to-mind communications. These are, sort of the gut feeling that we all have, that sense of knowing. And he told me later on that he knew that this wizard was God. And I said, well, how did you know it was God? And he said, because of the knowledge that was in his voice. I just knew it.
But we're tapping into...
So even though they described...
We're tapping into something that I think is universal. For instance, I think most of the animal kingdom communicates mind to mind. Birds and squirrels and all of that, they're all telepathic. And we don't, science thinks they must be pretty dumb because they can't speak like we do. But it's amazing the communities they create and how they get along and in ways that we can't comprehend because they are speaking to each other, but they're doing it in a different way. I think humans are kind of limited because we have these faculties that we think are only it.
Exactly. Okay. One of the main thing I've learned from studying near-death experiences is that we as human beings, we have so much more that we're capable of than just what we see with our eyes and just what we hear with our ears. That we really have the ability to communicate mind to mind, to directly to the mind of the universe.
But I think we're even cutting short how we see, because it's not like our eyes just see it. All we're getting are photons coming into our eyes. Our brain has to interpret it. And so it really is magical that we see and hear as humans anyway, because even our ears are only getting, noise that the brain then puts into, information. So maybe on the other side, it's kind of...
Absolutely. I love talking to you, Peter.
Thank you. I know it's so...
Well, because...
Talk with you.
It's because you intuitively understand a very profound scientific thought. See, science actually teaches us this, is that our universe is actually a universe that is filled with energy. That we are, in fact, beings of energy. So what is it that we're seeing? When we actually see and we touch things and we hear things, etc. Our body has biosensors, which analyze the energetic field around us And then we actually create in our mind these visual and auditory experiences.
Right.
So everything that is around us is something that we've created in our mind. And so that's wonderful because it allows us to talk with each other. And as I've learned from children, the reason that we're here in this earth is to learn our lessons of love and to be able to interact with each other. But it's also limiting in a way as well, because then we think that what we create with our mind is all that there is. And that's what studying near-death experiences did for me, was that suddenly I realized, hey, wait a minute, here's children who don't have a functioning brain. And yet they're accurately telling me their own resuscitation. For example, one child told me that she saw me wearing a hat while I was resuscitating her. And you might think that's weird. Why would I be wearing a hat? You know, you don't see that on TV. It's not a detail she could have made up. Well, she saw me wearing a hat because at our hospital, the team leader of a resuscitation wears a hat so that the leader can be quickly identified and, you know, the hubbub of resuscitation. And yet she saw that detail. But she's seeing through a different system of consciousness. And so we have two streams of consciousness as human beings. And I came to this as a scientist. So for those of you who have a philosophical or spiritual bent, you guys are saying, well, duh, you know, so he's finally figured out what we, you know, Tibetan monks knew 2,000 years ago. But human beings have two streams of consciousness. We have two ways of understanding the world. We have two ways of communicating and interpreting the world. And one is dependent on our five senses. And the other one is actually far more important. But it's also often obscured. You know, it's often hidden. Except for gifted people such as yourself.
We're using that all the time anyway.
Exactly.
I gave a talk about that recently because our conscious mind is only on the surface. The unconscious mind, the subconscious mind, is where all our dreams come from, where there's so much that our subconscious knows universally, but can only give us so much because we're so programmed in limitation to accept so little of it. And, you know, we, unfortunately, our conscious minds are really, you know, immature compared to our universal minds. And so
these are things that I learned from studying the near-death experience. Because think about what happens when we die. When we die, our conscious mind dies with us, our ego. And all that's left is what you're calling the unconscious mind. All that's left is our ability to communicate with the greater universe, our connection with this higher universal consciousness.
Right. But we become
and children
that.
Tell me this all the time.
Right, but we become
it. We become
that.
It, right. One child said to me, I went towards the light, but wait, I didn't go towards the light. I became the light. I was in the light. I was the light.
Wow.
It is the way that they'll often explain.
Yeah.
And they will say that soars, I heard the sound of the universe all wrapped up in a ball of light that was shouting so loud.
The line is breaking.
The unaware couldn't hear it, and the aware only thought that they did. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, no, but I caught most of that. That's good. But we're actually getting near the end of the show. Hopefully we can do more shows because this is
fascinating. I would love to do more shows with you. I love your breadth of knowledge is just astonishing. I'd love to share with you what we, you know, how medical science is basically just catching up with people like yourself.
Well, I'm honored to hear that from you. Thank you so much. But let the audience know more about your websites and how they can get more from you. So
my website is melvinmorsemd.com. I have links there to wonderful interviews with the children and the children's experiences, and they're describing, what they had. I also have another website that's spiritualscientific.com that has just dozens and dozens of interviews with children. And I wrote several books that are amazingly still in print. I wrote Closer to the Light, which is about near-death experiences in children. I wrote Transformed by the Light, which was what happens to these children when they grow up. You know, what is it like to have a lifetime of having a near-death experience early in your life, and then how that's affected you in your entire life? And it's just astonishing and
So much to explore with you going forward.
And
your line is breaking up again.
Experience.
Yeah. So
I'm sorry. Whenever we start to talk about spiritual things, that always happens. That's what I learned from Transformed by the Light. People that have near-death experiences frequently can't wear watches. Computers don't work around them and such as that.
Yeah, it's strange. So Melvin Morse, this is such a pleasure talking with you. And I'm looking forward to talking with you some more. Thank you so much for being an energy stew.
Oh, thank you so much. It's just a pleasure to interact with you. Thank you so much, Peter.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org. And I'd love to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening.